Someone once asked Sir Francis Bacon of his outlook for the future. He answered this way. He said, "You tell me what the young are thinking, and I'll tell you." Reminds one of the old adage that all of the flowers of tomorrow are in the seeds of today. Now that may sound rather trite, but that is profound. All of the flowers of tomorrow are in the seeds of today. Children are the raw material out of which the warp and woof of the social fabric is formed. So I want to talk about rearing children tonight. Be a little overlap with some of the things we said in the ladies' class yesterday. But I believe it'll be productive and helpful in our thinking with regard to responsibility toward our offspring. A little boy and his dad were visiting the zoo. They came to a cage that had the sign, "Wildcats." Little boy looked up at his father. He said, "Daddy, why do they call them wildcats?" And the father, momentarily stumped, finally blurted out, "Because their mother and father were wildcats." Now, good people, whether we like it or not, what our children ultimately become is largely contingent upon what we, as parents and grandparents, are. All the flowers of tomorrow are in the seeds of today. But someone said, "Preacher, we have so many young people today who have little regard for authority." Hey, the young people of this generation is the finest the world has ever produced. Don't make any mistake about it. It's there. Normally healthier, will be larger, according to medical science, have the opportunity of living longer than their predecessors, and they are certainly far more intelligent than any preceding generation. Young people of this generation is the finest the world has ever produced. Well, someone says, then, why do we have all of these problems? Why, let me read you a little piece here. I think you'll find it rather interesting if I can get it right. Our youths love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect to their elders. Children are now the tyrants and not servants of their households. And they no longer rise when their elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up their food, and tyrannize teachers. Does that sound familiar? Socrates wrote that in 400 B.C. Ooh, and I appreciate these young college students sitting on these front seats. I think that is wonderful indeed. Finest generation the world has ever produced. Friends, there have always been youth problems. Now, you think about it for a moment. Child born into this world, with what that he sees, is he familiar? Well, absolutely nothing. I mean, this is a brand new environment for him. He has a mind like a sponge. He soaks up everything he sees. Ooh, that little fellow just learning to crawl. Heads across the floor. He sees something over there, crawls over, grabs it, puts it in his tester. His tester. Slaps it in his mouth. Whoa, whoa, whoa. That's what parents are for, to keep him from putting the wrong thing in his mouth. And until he reaches his majority, the responsibility of parenthood is to keep him from putting the wrong thing in his heart and mind. Say, parenting is not a simple, easy task. They'll say, "Well, but preacher, there have always been youth problems." You think about it. If you went back to Genesis chapter 4, you'd find Cain murdering his younger brother, Abel. Ooh, think of the trauma in that family. Cain exiled, Abel is dead. I mean, the heartache of Adam and Eve. As a matter of fact, Moses had a youth problem. Different ones. Oh, Noah, for instance. If you went to Genesis chapter 6, Noah, of course, chosen of the Lord, he's doing the wonderful. But Ham, his son, yielded to immoral desire, brought a curse on his son, Canaan, the grandson of Noah. There have always been youth problems. Abraham? Oh, Abraham had a problem. Also, Genesis 21, Ishmael mocking Isaac. and said I couldn't tolerate that kind of thing. Lot had a youth problem, did he not? Two daughters with child by their own father. Now let it be said in their defense, they thought when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he had wiped out humanity entirely. And they knew the only possibility of the procreation of the human family was male and female. Nonetheless, a youth problem, indeed. And the two boys born to those girls ultimately became the avowed enemies of God's people at a later time. Youth problems have always been around. As a matter of fact, Isaac had a youth problem, did he not? You know, it's said that Jacob stole his brother Esau's birthright. And you can read about that in verses chapters 25 through 27 in the book of Genesis. And Jacob had a youth problem also. The 10 older boys sold their younger 17-year-old brother Joseph into foreign slavery 22 years before his father saw him again. Now you talk about a youth problem. David had a youth problem also, did he not? Absalom being a case in point. Usurped his father's throne, would have slain David had he been given the opportunity. Said, youth problems. Someone says, well, that's what I'm saying, preacher. I mean, they have little regard for authority. All kinds of atrocities are being perpetrated by young people. All of these youth problems were in consequence of parent problems. Adam had already introduced sin into the world before Cain slew Abel. Noah? Oh, Noah planted a vineyard after the flood and got drunk on the proceeds, and he himself was the very object of Ham's temptation, Genesis chapter 9. A parent problem. Abram? Oh, in chapter 15 of the book of Genesis, Abram in his prayer to God said, Eliezer, one born in my house will be mine heir. God said, not so. Your heir will come forth out of your own bowels. Took him outside, said, look at the stars. See if you can number them. So shall thy seed be. Ooh, and the rest of chapter 15, made a covenant with Abraham. And the very first verse of chapter 16 is Sarai, his wife. Later name changed to Sarah, of course, but seeing that she's too old to bear children, she said, you take my younger Egyptian handmaid, Hagar, use her as a servant mother, a concubine, a second wife, and he did. And Ishmael was born. If Abram and Sarai had allowed God Almighty to mind his own business, we wouldn't have the problem in the Middle East that we have today. Say. Ishmael and Isaac have been at it from the day they were born, and I have a feeling they'll be at it when Gabriel blows the trumpet. Say. When God makes a promise, forget it. He'll fulfill it. If he requires something of you, do it. But when God makes a promise, he fulfills that promise in his own time frame. Let it alone. They should have done. Oh, that was a parent problem. No question about that. Say. Well, yeah, but now somebody says, old Lot, for instance, he had that problem with his two daughters. You remember Lot was the nephew of Abraham? And they occupied the same range, and their flocks and herds grew too large, and they began to fight, their herdsmen, about territory and grazing land. And Abram took him out and said, now, let there be no strife between us. We be brethren. He said, you choose your direction. You go to the right hand, I'll go to the left. Ooh, Lot saw the well-watered plain of the Jordan. And being selfish, he chose that. And the record says he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. You mean to tell me that he chose to rear his children in a place where adulthood would look like a Sunday school picnic compared to what they were doing in Sodom? Sodomy is a synonym for homosexuality. God literally destroyed the cities of the plain so that today the exact location cannot be established on the map. Why did he destroy them? For the unnatural, unholy, sinful relationship of sodomy, homosexuality. And Lot chose to rear his children in an environment of that, you friend. Now, that's a parent problem. We need to be more careful of the environment and the associates of our offspring. Well, now, somebody said, but Isaac, you know, it's interesting. Isaac was growing old. His eye was dim. And they had two sons, Esau and Jacob. Esau was born first, though they were twins. And Esau was the favorite of his father, Isaac. He was a hunter, outdoorsman. And Isaac said to him one day, take thy weapons, harvest a deer, prepare me savory venison, that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die. He grabbed his bow and his quiver, and here he goes. Oh, but Rebecca, Isaac's wife, the mother of these two boys, heard it when Isaac made that request of Esau. And she said to Jacob, you go get me two kids of the goats, and I'll prepare savory food that thy father may eat, that he may bless thee. Let me just stop here and throw in a parenthetical statement that has nothing to do with the lesson at all. Either the taste buds of Isaac are totally dead, or Rebecca is the best cook the world has ever produced, because ain't nobody can make goat taste like venison. That's out of the question. It simply can't be done. Oh, but Jacob's smarter than that. Hell, he brought the goats, but it won't work. Oh, you see, my brother's a hairy man. Oh, I'm a smooth man. Oh, Rebecca had an answer for that. Put the goatskins on the back of his hand, the nape of his neck. Jacob's too smart for that. Won't work. You see, he's an outdoorsman, and I dwell basically inside, and we smell different. You ever notice that? Dad comes in from the field, hop up in his lap. Oh, it smells different from Mama. I don't know how bad smell. Smell of the plowed ground. The open field. Different. Well, Rebecca had an answer for that. She put the buckskins of old Esau on Jacob. What are we out here? We've got a parent problem. Oh, now God used this, understand, in the future, but that was a parent problem. Well, somebody said, yeah, but Jacob, when Esau on one occasion came in from hunting, had been unsuccessful, he's about to starve to death, he's been in the fields along, and old Jacob is cooking up a mess of pottage. Whoo! So old Esau comes in and says, move over, boy, I'm going to eat half that stuff. And that's it. Take care of it. If old Jacob said, you're not getting it, deck him. Brothers can do it. Yes, sir. He lives here too. Oh, but that wasn't what happened, was it? Jacob said, sell me thy birthright first. Birthright's birthright. If I'm dead, what good is it? He sold his birthright. And Jacob said, swear to me. He swore. Somebody said, well, now, Jacob shouldn't have done that. No, that's true. Jacob shouldn't have acted as he did. Oh, but that's not the problem. No, no. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16 tells you what the problem is. Esau was a profane person that despised his birthright. He didn't have to do that. All he had to do was just pick Jacob up and move him over and eat all he wanted. He's the firstborn. He lives there, too. He didn't have to sell his birthright. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? If we weren't careful, we blame a lot on youth that really is not their responsibility, actually. Jacob, those 10 older boys, somebody said, boy, there's no excuse for that. I mean, the older brother, when he's just 17, I'd rather understand how Jacob felt about Joseph. He's the firstborn of his beloved Rachel. And Rachel died giving birth to her second son, Benjamin. And he loved her the first time he laid eyes on her. I understand that, I say. Know exactly how he felt. But don't you ever, under any circumstances, show partiality to your children. Jacob made that mistake. Oh, he made a coat of many colors for Joseph. Why did he do that for the other? He gave special attention. They got so they couldn't stand him. They couldn't stand to hear him speak. They despised. Don't ever show partiality to your children. It is destructive. Say, oh, I realize that there may be qualities in one child that you appreciate more than those in the other. We understand that. But they're both your children. Never know really how they'll turn out. Well, I recall quite well. We had two boys and two girls. And old Bill, the older boy, he'd come in from school. And his mother would say to him, son, what happened to school today? built the love chair. I mean, he went into detail, everything that happened, every relationship, every conversation. He got the biggest bang out of that. He gave her the whole story. Old Alan come in, his mother would say, son, what happened to school today? Nothing. Shot two teachers, ran the school body off, and burned the building. Nothing. It's just different. It's just different natures. They've both been preaching the gospel for years, and they're fine gospel preachers. They'll beat their dad all to pieces in doing that, but don't ever show partiality to your children. Sure, qualities we appreciate, but they're both your children, you see. And you never know really how it's going to come out, actually. Yeah, kind of like the lady whose high school friend called her, been out of town, separated for years. She was in business. She's coming into town on business. Oh, her friend said, hey, don't you get a motel? I'll meet you at the airport. You're staying with me while you're here. Great. Picked her up at the airport. On the way home, this visiting lady said, now, let's see. You have three children? Right. John. How's John? Oh, John has a degree in philosophy. Well, what about Sue? Oh, Sue is principal in the grammar school here. What about Jim? Cropped her head, it's kind of quiet. And she said, Jim is a plumber. And then she added, if it weren't for him, we'd starve to death. He's the only one making money. So you never really know how things are going. Don't ever show partiality to your children. No, that was a parent problem. You see, Jacob was responsible for that. Yeah, but now David had already set the stage with his sin with Bathsheba. Parent problems. How to rear children in the 21st century. Four things. Number one, children need a godly example in the authoritarian figure within the family. That's you, Dad. The first concept a child entertains of the fatherhood of God, he learns from you. What do your children think of God? Oh, you say, well, now, Mom, nobody can take your place, Dad. You say, you're out a lot, you're working, you're moving, I understand about that, but you're Dad. Nobody can, our Mom does a fine job. Who takes care of the children, the house, etc., nobody can take your place. You're the father. You're the authoritarian figure. They need, especially in your life, a godly example. You know, about half the marriages in this great country of ours are ending in the divorce courts. That's a shame. Percentage is a little less than it was a few years ago, because today people are living in whoredom. They don't bother to marry. They just live together, and then when they break up, why, it's not going on the records, of course, as a home broken up. But that never happens, where Dad loves Mother more than his own life, and where Mom reciprocates that kind of love with respect. Child that grows up in a home where love is the dominating atmosphere knows that he belongs. Psychologically well adjusted, he's able to deal with his siblings and later with his peers in the business world. He understands who he is. He has a good degree of self-respect. But a child that is brought up in a home where there's bickering and argumentation and even cursing, and the statistics show that in most instances, he will develop a home for himself just like that. That is a shame and a disgrace. Let me do just a little bit more reading here. So important, Dad, that you have the right kind of influence upon your sons and daughters. To any little boys, Father, their little eyes upon you, and they're watching night and day. Their little ears that take in everything you say. There are little hands all eager to do everything you do. And a little boy who's dreaming of the day, he'll be like you. You're the little fellow's idol. You're the wisest of the wise. In his little mind about you, no suspicions ever rise. He believes in you devoutly, holds all that you say and do. And he will say and do in your way when he's grown up just like you. as a wide-eyed little fellow who believes you're ever right. And his ears are always open, and he watches day and night. You're setting an example every day in all you do for a little boy just waiting to grow up and be like you. Parenting, a tremendous responsibility. Godly example in the authoritarian figure within the family. Fundamentally important. Number two, love your children. Someone said, preacher, what else? Everybody loves their. Are you aware that in this great enlightened nation, 1.6 million mothers murder their innocent children every year? You are aware of that. Well, someone said, now, preacher, you're talking about abortion. You got that right. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, that's not murder. I mean, that's legal. That's not a child. When the sperm fertilizes the ovum in the womb of a woman and a life is begotten, that life is separate and apart from mother or father at that instant. The height of its stature, the color of its eyes determined at that moment. It can live up to 9 months in its mother's womb, up to 100 years more or less upon this earth. It can be murdered at any point along the way. Well, somewhat when the sperm fertilizes the ovum in the womb of a woman and a life is begotten, what kind of life is that? Swine, kine, bovine, equine, feline? I mean, what kind of life is that in the womb of a woman, friend? That's human life. Oh, have you ever read Mr. Webster's definition of murder? Yeah, to sum it up, the willful taking of innocent human life. And there's never been a more innocent human life than that child in his mother's womb. And should be in the safest place that it'll ever be in all of its earthly existence. Murder. If this drunken nation ever sobers up, comes to its senses, a lot of people have trouble living with themselves. Sure, we can talk to the Lord, we can repent, we can go ahead and be a faithful servant of God, but we have a tragic condition existing in our country today. Did you hear about the woman with a 2-year-old that went to the doctor's office? Back and forth in the waiting room. Finally, the nurse throws the door open, calls her name, points to the door into a chair, and she sits down, jumps up, back and forth. And finally, the doctor comes in. She's right in his face. She said, doctor, I am neither physically or psychologically prepared to care for another child. She said, I have this 2-year-old, and I'm expecting. She said, I want an abortion. Doctor finally calmed her down, sat her down in the chair, and he explained to her that there could very easily be long-term difficulties for the woman in consequence of an abortion. But he said, we don't have to run that risk. We don't have to worry about that. He said, you just give me the 2-year-old there on your lap. I'll take him into the lab. He'll not feel a thing. I'll inject. He didn't finish that. You talk about that proverbial duck on a June bug. I mean, that woman's all over him. You murder my child. You see, she'd had that 2-year-old long enough. Here's her life. Well, she'd have laid down her life for that babe without asking the question. No question. Well, wait a minute. What's the difference? Well, let's just try to illustrate it with warfare. You can don your uniform at 3:30 in the morning, climb into the cockpit of that big B-17, rise to a predetermined elevation, fly to the designated target area. And the bombardier, when you reach the general area, opens the bomb bay doors. Through the rifts in the cloud, the things begin to look about right, and when that picture is correct, lift that lever and death range, you bank that big job and see the flames and the smoke rising, and you may have focus or rising suns all over you. Depends on which area you may have been in. Yeah, but you've got a tail gunner and a turret gunner, and he'll take care of that. You get back to the landing strip. You can go into the mess hall, and you can order ham, bacon, or sausage, 2 eggs, toast or biscuit, hot cup of coffee. Eat a big breakfast, push your plate back, refill that coffee cup, push your chair back, and talk with your comrades. At war. Or you'd be lying in the grass and afraid to breathe, because you can hear the breathing of that oncoming platoon. One of them almost steps on the butt of your piece. top kid says, get the first man's jaw disappears at the butt of that thing. The next man is disemboweled at the bayonet. The third runs on it. You can't blow him off. You just blow him off with a gun. And you're screaming to the top of your voice. The lust of battle is upon you. Intend to kill everything in sight just as long as you're left standing. And all of a sudden, it's quiet. Except for that kid wallowing in his entrails there. He's not 20 years old. His parents are waiting for him to come home. You're cleaning the gore off of that bayonet, checking the bore of that piece to see that it's not stopped up so it doesn't blow up in your face, and you think maybe there's a beautiful young lady somewhere waiting for him to return. He won't return. Step quietly out on the dim trail back to the base camp. That's war. Yes, but there's a vast difference. One is somewhat remote. The other is eyeball to eyeball, hand to hand, blood to blood, life to life. We'll never die. That's, oh, that's it. That's it. That woman had this 2-year-old, but by the very idea, that's her baby. That's her. Oh, but she wouldn't have to hear the silent screams of that unborn child as that saline solution burnt the flesh from its body. She wouldn't have to hear those groans when the forceps pulled that limb from that yet not totally formed body. She wouldn't have heard those last groans when they put it in that plastic bag ready for the incinerator. That's the difference. Both are children. Both are human life. You see? That's the difference. She wouldn't have to witness the death of the unborn. Friends, children are the heritage of Jehovah. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Psalms 127 at verse 3. Oh, children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. I believe that's about Proverbs 17 at verse 6. There's nothing like holding your own flesh and blood in your hands. Marvelous indeed. It's somewhat like a new colt. Stands up the first time, you've seen him wobble, you wonder how he's going to stand on those legs, and then when he finally gets her running, leaning up against his mama, you think, that thing will never be big enough for a 200-pound man to put a saddle on him and straddle him. They grow up. The greatest thing in the world, seeing them grow and develop, and we're murdering 1.6 million every year. Love your children. Well, number three, discipline your children always with love for the good of the child. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in the chastening and the admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6 at verse 4. Well, somebody said, preacher, I love my child just too much to spank him. I couldn't whip my child. You better redefine your terms. Proverbs, what is that, 23? Chapter 3, verse 24. Oh, he that spareth the rod hateth his own son. He that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. You see, without discipline, the child simply cannot grow up with self-confidence, self-respect, the strength and the ability to deal with his fellow man. He doesn't really know who he is, from whence he came, or where he's going. And that's why sometimes they get frustrated. And we have teens today committing suicide. Can you imagine? Man, I grew up poor. We didn't have a lot of what a lot of folk had. You couldn't run after me fast enough to shock me, let alone me take my own gun, take my body. The very idea. Who ever heard of such a... Oh, but I knew who I was. I had a dad that loved me. I had a dad that occasionally said, go cut me a switch, son. You cut that switch, you test it, didn't sing, don't take it in. You'll have to go back. Sad. And he lectured me. He explained to me in great detail what this was all about. Here's the situation. This is what you did. Here's the opportunity you were given. Man, around and around that table we'd go. Shabow, shabow, shabow. And he'd say, now, son, this hurts me worse than that lion in his teeth. But did he quit killing me? But he was right. You see, my dad loved me. There's a fellow out there with a badge on his chest and a big iron on his hip. And he says, that boy of yours is going to live within the framework of existing authority. And he may not care how many knots he puts on his head or how many holes in his body. My dad didn't want knots on his son's head or holes in their bodies. So he corrected us. He did it in love. He explained why. Son, broken law has a penalty. And I'm glad I learned that. Oh, I'm so glad I learned that, you see. Discipline your children always with love. Proverbs 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he's old, he'll not depart from it. Preacher, are you telling me that if, as a Christian, I do the best I can to train my child, he'll never leave? No, that's a proverb. Proverbs states a conclusion that's generally true based upon certain conditions. Yeah, he may leave it. He may fight it. He may not like it. He may do everything within his power. But he can't lose it. Have you ever wondered about Hebrews 11, verse 24? By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, counting the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked unto the recompense of the reward. What are you talking about? Moses has been known all his life as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He grew up in the king's court. He's advanced in the wisdom and the power of Egypt. I mean, this, right? When Moses was 40 years old, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. You remember that Amram and Jochebed of the tribe of Levi married. And they had a son at a time when the Pharaoh that then reigned said any male child born to Hebrew women was to be slain immediately. Oh, this was a goodly child. They hid him for 3 months. But when they could no longer hide him, she made a little ark of bulrushes, wrapped the babe in swaddling clothes, and put that ark in the edge of the Nile. Miriam, his older sister, given the responsibility of looking out for it, checking on it. And Pharaoh's daughter came down to the Nile to drink. Or to bathe, brought her maidens with her. She saw that little ark out there. No doubt sent a couple of the girls out to get it, and they brought it back, and she unwrapped that babe, and he wept. And thank God, Pharaoh's daughter was a woman. God never made anything but her than a good woman. She loved that child. Well, Miriam said, would you like me to get one of the Hebrew women to nurse that child till he's weaned? For you know, she got it. Yeah. Jochebed, his mother. Oh, now the weaning process in that day was about like the time we send our children to school. 6, sometimes 8 years were involved in the weaning of a child. She had him 6 years. Right. And when he's 40 years old, he knows who his people are. He knows where he belongs. And he makes a choice to suffer rather than to enjoy the wealth and the riches. Right. Train up a child in the way he should go, and lose it. Or he may fight it, is that. But if he ever comes to himself like that prodigal son, Luke 15, in a hog pen, he doesn't have to wring his hands and say, I wish there was somewhere I could go, or I wish there was someone who cared. The light shines clearly in the window. The path back home clearly marked. And you do that by the time he's 6 years old. You say, if you are the kind of example that you should be teaching your children. What was it God said to ancient Israel? And it's true today, of course. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 through 9. He said, and these words which I command thee this day shall be upon thine heart. Thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Thou shalt speak of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. They shall be for signs upon thine hands. Thou shalt bind them for frontlets between thine eyes. Upon thy gates and upon thy doorposts shalt thou write them. Ooh, teach them casually, indifferently, diligently unto thy children. Important that they be, first of all, in your heart as a parent. Well, now somebody said, preacher, that was a sore pace. I mean, we don't have time today, man. We hurry, scurry. You have 168 hours every week. That's all Adam had. It's not a matter of time. It's a matter of priority. You fail to instill within the hearts and lives of your children the love of God and the knowledge of truth. If they reach their majority, they'll stand in judgment with you. Where are you sending your children? That's all that's important. Gain the whole world, lose your soul, then miss the point. Come on. Spiritual instruction. Well, but time, but he didn't take any of your time. You notice that? He didn't take any of your time at all. No, no. Thou shalt speak of them when thou sittest in thine house. You do sit down once in a while. No, it didn't say an hour and a half sermon. No, just a word or two backed up by that godly example. When thou walkest with the way, you do go out to the back 40 every once in a while, don't you? Sure. Look behind you. That little fellow with those short legs, he's trying to step in your footprints. Tell him why you have that thistle stick in your hand. I mean, especially when that little yellow finch just loves those thistle seeds when you allow them to grow. And they have a beautiful flower on them. I mean, why are you rooting up? Tell him about the noxious plant and why it came into existence. Tell him about that mountain over there, made purple by the intervening distance. Tell him about the beauty, the aroma of the fragile rose. How long will that take? A minute? Minute and a half? When thou liest down, you do go to bed. Son, you don't have to stay awake tonight. God never sleeps. And then a short prayer. Fine. Next morning, you may be late, running, hurrying, trying to sip that coffee, get your coat on. That's my dad. He understands that. Sure, he understands that. Godly example. Taking advantage of the opportunity to instruct your children in the love of God. I say, let what they see remind them of things spiritual. I say, teach your children the Word of God. That is so very, very important. Today, I was reading in the USA Today of a group of children, I say children, young adults, leaving the bars about 1:30 or 2 in the morning. And they've got a certain area right in a housing section where they slide their cars around and bump them into one another and stand on top of them and dance, and there's loud music going on. One lady had one of them rammed into her house and so on. What's the problem? Well, somebody says, oh, young people, boo, 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 boo. Those young people wouldn't be doing that if they had godly parents. You don't go to the bar. No. You don't conduct yourself that way. You don't imbibe alcoholic beverage. Well, somebody said, you can't keep you. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. My dad was a wise man. Not a highly educated fellow, did a lot of reading, but he was a wise man. And he didn't have to take 2.5 books to tell you what to do. I remember the time I could understand him till I left his tutelage. He said, son, you stay away from whiskey and sorry women and you'll be all right. I've been all over the world, both theaters. I've been in pubs with fellas drinking themselves bootlegged. When they get about 3 sheets in the wind, I was keeping their money. They hit it with the brothel. I hit it with the gangplank. Never tasted alcoholic beverage. Why? My dad said, don't do that. Yeah, but most people don't pay attention when parents love their children, when parents discipline their children. 99% of them will be governed by the tutelage, the teaching they received when they were young. I said, well, sure, some of them may go wild, but that'll be rare. That won't be the common experience today. Teach your children the truth, the love of God. That's done by, first of all, exemplifying it in your life. You know, sometimes, and I say that I've got to hush, but we have children's church, you know. I don't read a lot about that in Scripture. I don't know, you know. The best thing you can do for your children is to take them to worship with you and let them sit between you while you worship God. Well, somebody says, oh, man, they cut up, they aggravate the people behind them, and they may be writing on the book or not. Right, right. They have a mind like a sponge, taking in every word that's said. And besides that, there is no greater influence upon those children as they grow up to know that they were sitting between their parents as their parents worshiped God. That's the most important thing you can do for your children. Now, you send them to this, send them to that. Dad and Mom, That's your task. That's my task. Say, we train our children. You know, we had the boys up in bed one night, they're just small. And they were saying the books of the Bible. Old Bill, he said the books of the Bible. I don't know, 3 years old, maybe something like that. And we said, well, let's let Alan say the books of the Bible. That boy ran right through the books of the Bible, and you should have heard him pronounce Deuteronomy. I can't pronounce it like he did to save my life, but I know what he was talking about. Yes, sir. How do you learn that? Aggravating the people behind him until his mama stopped him, of course, doing something. Best thing you can do for your children. Keep them close in your heart through your teaching by way of your example. How to rear children in the 21st century. Godly example in the authoritarian figure within the family. Love your children. Discipline your children always with love for the good of the child. Teach your children. That'll work in any century. It doesn't matter when. Rearing children in the fear of the Lord. Friend, that's what parenting is all about. And today, if we aren't careful, many parents are abandoning the responsibilities that obtain in that relationship. Now, we haven't talked on first principles tonight, but it's possible that you are here and not a Christian. You believe in Christ. Why not make that faith a reality? Why not make up your mind that you're going to give your life in humble obedience to the Lord? And you think about it for a moment. A number of things that I've forgotten to say tonight. One of them was we've had fine song direction the whole meeting. Excellent. Good participation. But I want to read you a little poem that I believe will leave you with a lasting impression. The Builder's Temple. A builder builded a temple. He wrought it with grace and skill. Pillars and blocks and arches, all fashioned to work his will. And men said as they saw its beauty, it shall never know decay. Great is thy fame, O builder. Ah, thy fame shall endure for aye. A teacher builded a building with loving and infinite care, planning each arch with patience, laying each stone with prayer. And men scarcely noted the teacher, none knew of the wondrous plan, for the temple the teacher builded was unseen by the eye of man. Gone is the builder's temple, crumpled into the dust. Low lies each stately pillar, food for consuming rust. But the temple the teacher builded will last while the ages roll, for that beautiful unseen temple was a child's immortal soul. That's all that counts in this life. Tonight, if your subject in any way is an alien sinner or an erring child of God, or if you need the prayers of the saints, if we can help you in any way, why not come? Make your wishes known while together we stand and sing.